Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Chris Molina. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll find out how museums are branching out and trying to incorporate technology and much more into their exhibits.
Now, rumors are swirling on Capitol Hill that Attorney General Jeff Sessions could be out of a job following the midterm elections. President Trump and Sessions have had a tumultuous relationship since the Attorney General recused himself from the special investigation, which is looking at Russian meddling in the 2016 elections and allegations of collusion.
President Trump doubled down on his displeasure with Sessions, both in a recent interview with Fox News and on Twitter this morning. Our next guest is here to lay out what the next few weeks could look like for both men as we get closer to the election and as special counsel Robert Mueller's investigation continues.
Daniel Lipman is a reporter for Politico and the co-author of the Politico Playbook. Daniel, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Briefly, how would you characterize the relationship between President Trump and Attorney General Jeff Sessions?
Oh, it's one of the worst relationships between a cabinet member and a president in U.S. history, because usually presidents pick someone for these important roles that they trust and that they can get along with. And Trump is vindictive against someone he wants to really weighed the scales of justice in his favor, and Sessions recused himself, and he's never forgiven him for that.
So Sessions recused himself from overseeing the Robert Mueller special counsel investigation, and Trump was furious about that, and he has been threatening towards Sessions and demeaning in a lot of ways ever since day one that Sessions took the job. But in the past, prominent Republicans have defended Sessions and said, you know, he needs to stay in place. This needs to keep going. What are we hearing now that, and what has changed that Republicans are saying, yeah, he's probably going to get the boot after the election?
I think they can never tell exactly what's happening at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue because Trump himself doesn't even know what he's going to do. And so how could Republican senators divine that? But there's an increasing realization in Washington that Trump is, you know, eventually will try to get rid of Sessions, and that could cause it to be very hard to get a new nominee to be Attorney General through Congress because, you know, the Senate is made up of a bunch of Republicans who are not going to be eager to help Trump interfere with this investigation. So it's also going to be a race against time in November. How long will it take Mueller to complete his investigation? Because if he can complete it and then Sessions is still in there, then it doesn't even matter what he does because, you know, Trump can fire Sessions. There would be no real world impact on this important investigation.
I do want to talk about what the fallout might be if Sessions is fired after the midterms. But I want to pause first and go back to those Republicans. Bob Corker of Tennessee, also Lindsey Graham, have signaled that they think this is likely to happen, that Jeff Sessions will get fired. What do you think? None of those statements are, you know, off the cuff. They're for a reason. What do you think has changed that they are putting that out there?
I think based on Trump's behavior and his tweets, which seem to get worse against Sessions every day. And so it's a recognition of reality. But with Lindsey Graham especially, he was saying last year that holy hell would be raised if Trump made this drastic move. And now he says, well, the president deserves an attorney general he trusts and gets along with. And so it's been a reversal from Graham's part. And Graham has become, you know, buddy-buddy with Trump. They go golfing sometimes. And this is a guy that, remember, famously, Trump read out Lindsey Graham's personal cell phone number at a rally just to mess with him. And so, you know, but once the president of your own party is in charge at the White House, it's very hard for Republicans to stand up to him. And you see, you know, there's always that question of when is the line going to be crossed. But for a lot of Republicans, it doesn't even matter what Trump does. They will still kind of be very meek in how they deal with him.
Lindsey Graham did say he really hoped this would not happen before the midterms because it would throw things into chaos. But what would the fallout be if it happened even after the midterms? What kind of response would there be? I think we can guess what Democrats would say, but within the Republican Party, would there be a problem?
Among some people, yes, but among many other Republicans who are loyal supporters of Trump, it doesn't matter what Trump does. They will still support him. But it would create a huge firestorm in the media if there's still an active investigation, because and it might be hard to have a new nominee for the Justice Department, because who's going to take that job, you know, when they know that for certain they're going to just get bombarded with requests by Trump to interfere in the investigation. And so then the if he did fire Sessions and didn't have a replacement immediately confirmed, then you have Rod Rosenstein, who actually now has a good relationship with Trump, because you know, they get along on enforcing immigration laws very strictly. But you know, Rod is in charge of the investigation, has done a good job overseeing it. And so Rod could be in there for a while, and Trump might not get what he wants. And he doesn't. He's tweeted bad things against Rosenstein in the past. And so kind of a lose-lose in many senses. We just don't know how it would ultimately play out.
We are talking with Daniel Lipman right now. He's a reporter for Politico and the co-author of the Politico Playbook. We are talking about the rocky relationship between President Trump and Attorney General Jeff Sessions. And as we said, President Trump did talk on Fox and Friends this weekend and criticized Sessions. Let's hear a little of what he had to say.
Jeff Sessions recused himself, which he shouldn't have done, or he should have told me. Even my enemies say that Jeff Sessions should have told you that he was going to recuse himself, and then you wouldn't have put him in. He took the job, and then he said, I'm going to recuse myself. I said, what kind of a man is this? And by the way, he was on the campaign. You know, the only reason I gave him the job, because I felt loyalty. He was an original supporter. Mm-hmm. He was on the campaign. He knows there was no collusion.
So the president says that he hired Jeff Sessions because he saw him as loyal, not necessarily, you know, based on any other qualifications. Is this a usual way to choose an attorney general, first of all?
No, that's a simple answer. Of course you want cabinet members who are loyal, but the Justice Department is something different. It's not like the Small Business Administration where, it's, you know, you don't have constitutional questions every day. And the rule of law is very important in this country, and Trump seems to have never learned that lesson, or he is, you know, willing to basically subvert American history and precedent, and, you know, he doesn't understand the checks and balances. And also, you want to have judicial independence. No, like, we don't want to live in a banana republic. And so, you know, it's hard for him to put the rule of law above his own political interests. And you know, it's very concerning, no matter if you're a Republican or a Democrat, because what if there is a really leftist person who becomes president and then there's an investigation? You don't want the norm to be, hey, I can interfere in it. Even Republicans, that's how one would make an argument to them about the importance of the rule of law.
And President Trump today on Twitter criticized Sessions for not prosecuting groups like the Democratic Party for what he alleges was illegal surveillance of his campaign, and said that the American people were still waiting for Jeff Sessions to take over the Department of Justice. What impact does that back and forth bickering have on trust in the institution?
I think it's really been hurt. And you look at polls, and a lot of Trump supporters, they don't believe in the FBI or DOJ anymore. They are very suspicious. What I thought was the most interesting thing that happened this week is that Sessions fought back, and you know, after a bunch of tweets in that interview, that Trump gave to Fox News, he said, "I'm not going to let political concerns interfere in our department," and he did say, "I took control of the Department of Justice on day one," and so he's in open defiance. And then later that day, he went over to the White House and they had a meeting about an unrelated topic. And so I think it was criminal justice reform. So yeah, pretty interesting day at the office in the Trump administration when you have this split screen of them battling it out over press releases and tweets and cable news interviews. And then, you know, they still have to work together on some important issues.
Well, Daniel, thanks so much for spending time with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Daniel Lipman is a reporter for Politico and the co-author of the Politico Playbook. He joined us today to talk about the possibility of President Trump firing Attorney General Jeff Sessions after the November midterm elections and how their rocky relationship has developed to this point. It seems like museums are having a moment, and for good reason, too. There are a lot of interesting museums around the nation. Just to name a few, there's the Museum of Death in Los Angeles, or the Museum of Bad Art in Somerville, Massachusetts, and even a World of Accordions Museum in Superior, Wisconsin.
And speaking of Wisconsin, the Milwaukee Public Museum is a popular museum in the state, and it's possibly most known for its Streets of Milwaukee exhibit and its Butterfly Room.
And now they're beginning to imagine how to make the museum even better as they plan a new home. They're dreaming big about possible designs and asking the question, what makes a well-loved museum even better?
Hillary Olson is Vice President of Audience and Community Engagement at the Milwaukee Public Museum. Hillary, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
So part of the reason that we're having this conversation today is the Milwaukee Public Museum is sort of re-envisioning what the museum could be going forward and with potentially a new space, too. With that in mind, is this an exciting time for you and for museums in general?
Oh, it is an absolutely exciting time for me and the Milwaukee Public Museum. And really, the museum field overall has been going through sort of a renaissance of inspirational design and activity and really including more people in our process. So the entire field is on board and getting into sort of the new century, and it's an exciting time.
Let's talk about that word museum. I think for some people it conjures up images of going into a gallery, looking at a picture on the wall or a collection of something. It doesn't need to be just that, right?
Not at all. Museums right now, and that's part of that renaissance, are really moving from what we would consider that sort of old school temple to more of a forum. So it's an activity. It's a way to get people involved and have conversations and giving people a voice in the stories we tell and the lens through which we tell them. We're not experts in Native American cultures. We have some, but we also partner with Native American tribes across Wisconsin to help tell their stories of cultures past and present, and museums are doing that everywhere. It's a really exciting time to really get the community deeply involved in what we do.
Do you have a hard time maybe overcoming some of those stereotypes that people might have about museums, especially people who may not have been to a museum since that, eighth grade field trip many years ago?
Yeah, we see a lot of people that had that experience. They came once and they've never come back. And either when they walk through the door or when we're engaging people in the community, which is definitely something that we're doing more and more often, we are finding that people don't remember that they have a chance or don't know that they have a chance to get hands-on with some of our education, immersed in a deep experience that it's not just about coming and seeing and not touching anymore, but we're having those forum-based conversations. This is the place that you can get more deeply involved and have those experiences that involve all of your senses, not just vision.
And I'm also curious, too, a few weeks back I was out in Seattle and I went to the Seattle Pinball Museum and I had this moment where I was like, wait, this is a museum?
Sure.
This is fun. Are museums allowed to be fun?
Oh, museums are not only allowed to be fun, we are fun. This is a place to go not only for kids and families, but for anyone of all ages to have fun, to get hands-on, to learn more, to maybe sing or dance, to explore something that you maybe haven't thought about in the past. We are absolutely fun.
And part of your job is to make sure that the visitor experience to the museum is a great one. And I had read an article with you in the past talking about refocusing on the visitor experience for your museum visitor. Talk about what that entails.
Well, that's really looking at from the visitor experience from knowledge that we exist and making sure that people see us out in the community and, visit our website and hear about us from so many different ways, all the way through to their parking experience and their retail and food services experience, and then all of their experiences within the museum and making sure that we are telling the stories that we need to tell, that we're involving them in asking questions and really assessing what they know and what they want to know and giving them that best experience that makes them not only want to learn more but to come back and do this again or to go to a different museum.
And talk more about some of the other challenges you're facing. You know, we hear a lot about technology, about how everyone is walking around with a cell phone in their pocket now. Does that have an impact on the kind of programming and the kind of initiatives that you do at a museum?
So for the last 20 years, museums have been sort of fretting about the prospect that the digital experience could possibly bring some people away from the museum experience that we want to offer them. But the exact opposite is turning out to be true. Visitors are more than ever wanting to see the authentic objects. They want to have an enhanced experience using that phone that's probably in their pocket. We offer apps to increase our accessibility levels. We have audio tours in the streets of Old Milwaukee. We have a lot of other digital tools, like if you see a mummy, you can now come into the Milwaukee Public Museum and see a mummy, but also see a CT scan of what's happening in that mummy's head that you never would have been able to see 30 or 40 years ago. So we're really embracing the digital, but understanding that people come to museums to see the authentic objects that we hold and care for.
We're talking right now with Hillary Olson. She is the Vice President of Audience and Community Engagement at the Milwaukee Public Museum. And Hillary, as Milwaukee goes forward with dreaming about future possibilities, I would imagine you're looking to some other museums for ideas and for inspiration. Are there certain museums or certain initiatives that they are doing that you're really looking towards and thinking, man, we would really love to do this here in Milwaukee?
Many museums in the world, in our country, there's more museums than you could ever imagine, and everybody's doing something that's amazing. So we are really looking to those museum associations, the American Alliance of Museums, the Association of Science and Technology, the Association of Midwest Museums, to find out and help us get close to what's happening everywhere. And really, the planning process is going to allow us to take the very best of the best and put that in our design. So it might be something having to do with the best practices in accessibility and making sure that we are so far beyond ADA compliance in the way that we are engaging people with disabilities in our museum. It's research best practices. It's making sure that people understand that we have a collection that is actively used in research, and how can we share that with the public. And there are places that have a research scientist that's doing their work that the public can actually see and engage with. And those are the exciting moments of who's doing what that's amazing, and we will collect all of that and make sure that that's part of our planning. That's the beauty of a brand new plan.
Is there a lot of collaboration happening in the museum world right now?
Yes, more than ever. There's always been museum conferences and museum best practices, but more than ever, people are deciding that nobody needs to reinvent the wheel once you've discovered something that works or something that's truly engaging. There's no reason why you can't take that idea and turn it into your own, take your own content with that idea and make something amazing out of that. There's a lot of research that goes into how people use museums and what they do and how they do it and why they come. We actually know that the number one reason why people come to museums is to have fun. So we need to sort of take that and harness that reason and make sure that we are offering that. But all the other museums work together on making that cultural experience, not only in Milwaukee and Wisconsin, but the United States and the world, is to make that the very best it can be and continue to get people involved in what we're doing every day.
I'm also curious, there's always going to be those people out there who say, I want the traditional museum experience. I don't want the interactive displays. I don't want the touch screens. I don't want to be distracted because I get distracted everywhere else. How would you respond to someone like that?
You know, the thing is that the way that MPM is approaching that is you don't have to. There's nothing that says you have to have that interactive experience. We are not a science and technology center. While we do have quite a good deal of science and natural history, we are not a screen-based museum. We are a collections-based museum. While we can use screens to enhance or use technology to enhance any experience, we are never going to take away that authentic object, that experience of seeing a diorama, of seeing the true thing from anyone. So while we might use it to enhance that and people might love that, there's that other traditional sort of viewer that we're not going to lose. So you can have many different experiences in one place.
Wisconsin, here in Wisconsin, we have so many great museums, and we have a wide variety of museums. For every Milwaukee Public Museum or Milwaukee Art Museum, you've got a museum of angel figurines or a museum of accordions. Is what you're talking about here a message that's applicable to any kind of museum, no matter what's on display?
Yes, if it's a collecting museum, then absolutely. If there is a collection to showcase, you know, the bobbleheads, the accordions, whatever that is, then people, the reason that people go to museums is to have fun, but exploring that authentic object, having that connection with the actual thing versus a facsimile or a screen-based thing. So all museums can learn from that, and all museums are learning from these best practices, making sure that we are displaying those objects in such a way that is accessible and understandable, but the technology can allow us to go deeper into that, and each of us needs to make sure that we're doing that as well and serving the people that want to know more.
And as we begin to wrap up here, Hillary, I've got to admit I've never been to the Milwaukee Public Museum because I'm a bad person and I'm uncultured.
Oh.
So
make, you're not uncultured.
Make the case that this is a museum that I need to get out and I need to see pretty soon.
This is an amazing place. And while we are looking to the future right now, what the museum holds, we have 3 floors of artifact-heavy, amazing exhibitions going from the Silurian Sea all the way to the Arctic, all the way to cultural exhibitions, the history of Milwaukee, dinosaurs, live butterflies in a vivarium that can land on you. It's not a one-hour experience. This is a day-long, exciting, fun experience for adults, for kids, for families, for school groups. It is an amazing place, and there's quite a good deal of the experience that we offer in this place that we will never not offer, no matter where we are.
And do you have a favorite part of the museum, or is that like asking you to pick your favorite kid?
It's like asking me to pick my favorite kid, but I do really enjoy insects. I love bugs. So that butterfly vivarium and our live insect display, which is right now being renovated and will be open very soon, those are my favorites.
Well, Hillary, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Chris.
That was Hillary Olson, Vice President of Audience and Community Engagement at the Milwaukee Public Museum. She joined us to talk about how museums are making things of the past interesting to the visitors of today.
For a lot of home chefs, cooking for a big group can be intimidating. There's deciding on your main dish and then what drinks and appetizers to pair it with.
Not to mention figuring out how to actually make the meal that usually feeds your family of four for 20 or 30 people. Well, that's where our next guest comes in. She's got some great advice for feeding a lot of mouths at once and building some community in the process.
Leslie Jonath is the founder and creative director of the content company Connected Dots Media. She's worked on many cookbooks and was the editor of Feed Your People, Big Batch, Big Hearted Cooking, and Recipes to Gather Around. Leslie, welcome to Central Time.
Hello.
Thanks so much for joining us. I'm excited about this because I love cooking for a big group of people. And it seems like a lot of the themes in this book about community and food are really embodied in a project called the 18 Reasons Community Dinner in San Francisco. So let's start with you telling us a little bit about that project.
Well, 18 Reasons is a beloved nonprofit in San Francisco that hosts community dinners and also has a wonderful Cooking Matters program. They are very well known for being a wonderful cooking school, and they host many different kinds of cultural foods from around with local cooking teachers.
And go ahead.
No, and I actually met them because in San Francisco, I attended one of their community dinners, and it was just so wonderful to meet everybody and to be so welcome into that world.
And the director of 18 Reasons wrote an intro in your book, and in that she claimed that cooking helps us reclaim control of our lives. Do you think there's something to that, that we've kind of become disconnected from cooking and we can kind of take some control back?
Well, cooking is actually a great pleasure when it's done with a kind of relaxation and in community. And so I think that, yes, cooking together is something that people often think of as a chore when it can be something that brings us together.
One of the things I really love about the book is that you have recipes from chefs that are specifically big batch recipes for parties and group events. And I'm sure that, you know, while chefs are often putting out one plate or two at a time, there is that, you know, that idea of scaling up because you don't want to run out of a particular dish. Why did you want a cookbook focused on cooking for large groups of people and not just something like weeknight dinner options?
Well, actually, I like to cook more for big groups of people than I like to cook for weeknight. It's just something that's specific to me. I think it's just because I like that sense of collaboration and community. But as a long-term cookbook editor, I was surprised to see that there weren't that many books out that were about feeding 10 to 20 to 30 people. And if you need instruction, that's the time when you need it. Most people think that you can just double a recipe and that it will work. And in some cases, many cases, that's true. But there's all kinds of issues around equipment and timing that having the kind of tips and instructions is incredibly helpful for home cooks.
And I'm wondering, too, Leslie, when we think about cooking for a large group, you know, we might be thinking about quality, or we might be thinking about quantity, but does that mean we have to sacrifice quality in the process?
It doesn't. I think that one of the reasons I chose to work with all these different chefs, 60 in total, was because I wanted to find the best recipes I could, the kind of their go-to dishes. So you have minestrone by Alice Waters, which is very simple. A lot of the work is in the chopping. Or you have, you know, Ashley Poole's beautiful macaroni and cheese, which is only 4 ingredients. So it's not the difficulty of the recipe. It's the style and the ingredients in the recipe, I think, that can make a big difference.
I want to go back to something that you just touched on, equipment, because I think that's one of the challenges is you think, oh, yeah, I can double or triple this recipe. And then you realize that the pot is overflowing or you've got 2 pots going of the same thing. And yeah, it can get a little out of hand. And you know, because this is maybe not the type of cooking that we do more than a few times a year, what advice do you have for basic equipment that can help us do this successfully?
Well, I think equipment, what we did when we did the book was to make the book appeal to the home cook. So restaurant chefs and restaurants, they have stoves that have a higher BTU. They have big pots. But we realized that if you're asking people to make a big pot of soup, then it's going to take maybe longer to cook. So when we were creating the recipes, we often made decisions and made advice based on maybe not doing a big pot of soup, but creating 2 medium-sized pots, because then essentially you're getting a better cook and you have access to the equipment. You didn't have to get any specialty equipment. So I think if you just have a couple of large stock pots, if you have ladles, if you have basic equipment, you can do this kind of cooking. It's just about how you strategize. Also, when we were talking about big batch cooking, there are all kinds of tricks that we tried to alert the reader to that you may not think of, as you were saying. For example, sometimes people don't understand when they're getting a lot of ingredients, you need a place to put them in the refrigerator. So one of the first things I advise people to do is before you cook for a big party, clean out the refrigerator. Clean it out as empty as you can because you're going to need to put someplace, you're going to need to put the ingredients somewhere before you start cooking.
And speaking of tricks for cooking for a large group, the last time I hosted a large group of people at my house, I ended up dumping a bunch of stuff into a crock pot and then just letting it sit there. And I almost felt bad about it because, you know, I have family coming over. I want to impress the family. I want to put out a really good meal. And I almost felt this weird guilt that I was serving something out of the crock pot. And I love the crock pot. I really do. But is it okay? Can we give ourselves that leeway to hit the easy button every once in a while when we're cooking for a lot of people?
Absolutely. I mean, most of what people remember, they remember the food, but most of what people remember in gatherings is the conversation. And most of what people want is they want the host to be relaxed. You know, there's something about cooking by yourself and being stressed out that by the time your guests get there, you know, you're too stressed to actually enjoy the party. So if you have a crock pot or you want to get, you know, beautiful roast chickens from your favorite market and then supplement it with something else, you know, that's many, many ways to feed a big group. It doesn't always have to be, you know, a showstopper. In the book, we have a lot of really showstopper recipes, but we also have some simple recipes that anyone can make.
And we'll definitely talk about some of those. We're talking with Leslie Jonath right now. She's the editor of Feed Your People, Big Batch, Big-Hearted Cooking, and Recipes to Gather Around. And going back to Chris and his crock pot, I would be happy to eat from your crock pot,
Thank
Chris,
you.
Just so you know. you know, Leslie, you talk about your family having an annual gathering called the Latke and Vodka Party, and there's an interesting way that your family makes that doable so that you can all enjoy it at the same time at the party. Tell us about that annual party.
Well, the annual party started small, and I would ask my mother, I would tell her, I'm having the party. And she would say, I'm not doing it at this year. No way. And then I would just wait a week, and she would call me and say, okay, I've made 180 latkes. When's the party? And the way that she does it is she makes batches. The recipe in the book serves 25, 30 latkes, and she'll actually make the latkes in batches and freeze them. And then she puts them between, you know, she puts them in a cooler and then brings them to my house and then bakes them off at the party so that everybody can have a beautiful hot latke, but she can enjoy it. She can serve it. She's not sitting over a pan of hot oil slaving away. It really is a great way to entertain.
So and we should make sure people know that latkes are delicious, amazing potato pancakes.
Yes, potato. They're beautiful, crispy potato pancakes that you top with sour cream or applesauce.
And you mentioned this before, Leslie, but I want to really just kind of drive this point home. I know, I think you were like me at one point in that when you were inviting people over to the house for a dinner party or an engagement, you were the one that wanted to do all the cooking. You wanted to make sure that, you know, okay, my guests are coming. I don't want to burden them. I want to have everything ready to go. And you say, no, bring them into the kitchen. Get them involved in the process. And that's half of the fun.
Bringing people together around cooking is a wonderful way to break the ice. I found that when you invite people to cook, you're actually inviting them to the party. People talk a lot about the after party and being there after, but I like the before party. And I usually have my mom, or I have my best friends, or I have my daughter, and we do all the prep cook together. You know, for the minestrone soup I mentioned, there's a lot of chopping. And so we'll sit together or we'll, you know, over our cutting boards and we'll talk and we'll chop and we'll, it's really a way to be together. So sharing the work is part of the party.
One of the things that I really appreciated about your book is that when you look through it, it's clear that you've made a point of really capturing a diverse set of recipes from cultures all around the world. And what that really said to me is that this is really a universal value, bringing people together, large groups of people together to create community and eat.
The cultural, the amount of different kinds of gatherings was so amazing in that I couldn't decide. That was the hardest part of the book. There were so many interesting traditions. I could write a whole nother book, but I'm not going to because we know how much work it is. But it was such a pleasure to be working with all these different cooks and chefs. And one of the things that I thought was the most interesting was how people feed their people. So there's a whole section in the book about cooking, making small bites with people. So you can do empanadas, tamales. You can do onigiri, which is a beautiful rice ball. The Japanese make this gorgeous rice ball that with kids where they decorate it. So cooking with your people, as I was saying with the minestrone recipe, cooking with your people is really a lovely way to bring people together in all cultures.
And I'm wondering, too, about finding inspiration for these recipes. Recently, I was at home and going through some old cookbooks, trying to actually get rid of some stuff, and found an old church cookbook that we had that had a recipe for, like, macaroni salad for 100 people, which I was just kind of blown away by. And then I thought, okay, you know, like potlucks and stuff, there's always these recipes that we kind of fall back on when we are planning for a potluck or a party. And I'm wondering, you know, where else you find this inspiration for recipes for large groups of people to mix it up a little bit.
Well, first of all, I love those church cookbooks, and I think those, and there are those kinds of recipes which, you know, to serve 100, and you can just see people gathering in a big church and having a big dinner like that. It's so wonderful. So, but again, I think a lot of it was I asked a lot of different people, what do you cook for your people? And there were some recipes that were universal in my community, whether it was paella or it was porchetta or, you know, big pasta dinner. So there's certain kinds of things that are just go-to dishes that I found to be common to a lot of people. A lot of people had those kinds of dishes which were almost childhood nostalgia dishes, comfort food. That was what a lot of people went to, or things they remembered from, you know, holidays or traditions. But I think a lot of it just is talking to people and finding out what people eat. And also just because there are so many cultures that do this. I mean, Mexican cooking, there's that carnitas in the book, which is really easy and just feeds a lot of people. So it was a real pleasure to look at different traditions.
And we are going to dig into some of those recipes in just a moment. But right now, just wanted to let everyone know we are talking with Leslie Jonath. She is the editor of the cookbook, Feed Your People, Big Batch, Big-Hearted Cooking, and Recipes to Gather Arounds.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What recipes do you like to make for parties or get-togethers? Have you tried any that didn't quite work out as well as you wanted for a big group? What dish brings your friends and family together? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org.
We'll pick up this conversation after the short break here on Central Time. Right now, we're picking up our conversation with Leslie Jonath. She is the founder and creative director of the company Connected Dots Media, and she's the editor of the book Feed Your People, Big Batch, Big-Hearted Cooking, and Recipes to Gather Around.
And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. What dishes for dinner parties and gatherings do well at your table? What memories do you have of great get-togethers with your friends and family? And what questions do you have about scaling up a recipe that you want to try out with a crowd? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can tweet us at Central Time WPR. And on Facebook, Leslie, Kim and Linda both said that they love to make lasagna for a crowd, and I will say I agree with that. Linda also said spaghetti or even baked spaghetti. And one of the recipes that you gave us to share that people can find at WPR.org/Food Friday is the Pool's Diner Macaroni au Gratin from Ashley Christensen. Tell us about that dish. It sounds delicious already.
This macaroni au gratin is one of my favorites. One of the things that we did during the book was we did recipe testing dinners at 18 Reasons where we made it for 20. So we made this macaroni au gratin for 20 people. And it only has four ingredients. It has three different kinds of cheese and heavy cream. And it is beyond. And you broil it at the end so it gets this crispy top. It is so delicious and so filling that it's a crowd pleaser.
And what kind of side dishes and things kind of pair well with a macaroni dish?
Well, this dish is so rich. And again, the whole thing about the book is that, you know, ideally you personally, just the host, makes one dish and then you have your guests bring everything else. So in this case, we just recommended people get a beautiful green salad. It doesn't even have to be complex, but just a great green salad. You could, you know, have some sort of a cocktail to begin with. But I think, you know, you don't need a lot with this.
And there's a whole chapter in the book that is pasta, noodle, and rice dishes. What is it about that kind of grouping that is so well suited to cooking for a crowd?
I think the thing about pasta dishes is, number one, they're pretty inexpensive, and it really depends on your topping. So I think the thing about, they're very versatile kinds of dishes, and you can do a lot of it ahead of time. So as you mentioned, the lasagna, we have a gorgeous lasagna from Joyce Goldstein, and she teaches you how to make a bolognese sauce, which you could make, you know, a month ahead even, keep it in your freezer, and then you could use it for the lasagna, or you could use it for pasta. We also have a paella. Again, a paella is a dish which has so many different iterations. So once you learn our paella, maybe that will embolden you to try some other kinds of paella recipes.
Moving on to a different kind of cuisine, this is something that I do in my own house, is barbecue. And we heard from Chris on Facebook who says he likes barbecue because much of it can be made ahead, a smoker can be stoked and left, and you can drink and mingle. And Leslie, you do include some barbecue in the book, and I want to talk about this recipe for root beer barbecue spare ribs from Rick Rogers. Tell us about this recipe.
Rick Rogers is a wonderful, wonderful cookbook author who's written and maybe co-written, I think maybe 40. Rick, if you're listening, is it 40 books, 50 books? He's amazing. So Rick also has a very strong background in catering. And when I started this book, he was one of the first people I went to talk to about this particular category. Barbecue is one of the best ways to feed a crowd. You could do a whole Feed Your People about barbecue. Mm. These barbecued spare ribs are cooked on indirect heat. They're actually braised first, so you can prepare them ahead of time, and then your guests can come and you can finish them off on the grill, which means that they don't take so long, so you can enjoy your guests, have a little something to eat and drink, and then you can finish off the spare ribs and have a wonderful dinner.
What does the root beer do in the recipe? Because that's an interesting ingredient.
It flavors it. It tenderizes it a little bit, but really it gives it this lovely smoky sweetness. It's delicious.
I've been curious about that too, because I make a lot of pulled pork and other barbecue stuff in the crock pot, and I've seen recipes. Yeah, the crock pot. Judith is laughing at me. You know, and I've seen you can do it with root beer, you can do it with Dr. Pepper, you can do it with cherry cola. Leslie, are all these good options, and do you have a favorites?
Well, Well, I mean, I'm partial to root beer myself. I think there is a tradition of Coca-Cola and different kinds of sodas for barbecue, just again, because of that sweetness, the way that it combines with the meat, it just makes it really delicious.
And of course, no gathering, whether it's one person or 50 people, is complete without desserts. And you've got a lot of really tasty things to pick from. Emily Lachetti's lemon blueberry trifle looked amazing. First of all, tell us what a trifle is.
A trifle was actually dessert that was traditionally served at Christmas, and it's layers of sponge cake with cream, whipped cream, and berries. And sometimes it has a splash of alcohol, but in this recipe, it doesn't. And what Emily did is she created one basic recipe and then gave variations. So in addition to the lemon blueberry trifle, she also does a strawberry one, and she also does a roasted pineapple coconut trifle. So it's one dessert format and then a couple of different iterations. But this one with the blueberries and lemon, it's actually lemon curd, is spectacular.
I should say that we have all these recipes up on WPR.org/Food Friday. And we're getting low on time, but I do want to read this comment, Leslie, from Aaron in Nina, who emailed to say, I'm originally from Lower Michigan, but my family is from the Upper Peninsula, where they lived in a mostly Finnish neighborhood. My grandparents would make pasties all the time for meals, and we would go out and do something. My mother would do the same when I was growing up. At age 40, I still see that word, and I still think of family outings and meals about Mackinac Island or Iron Mountain. Is that something that you've tried for a group gathering, Leslie?
I have not, but I think he needs to write that recipe and send it to me for volume two.
It's kind of like a Finnish empanada.
It's so beautiful. I was actually just in Sweden, and I didn't see that, but man, that sounds incredible.
You know, I want to ask you, Leslie, the title of your book, Feed Your People. Who are your people? Who do you consider that kind of tribe?
You know, I think that's such a great question. There's something about just taking care of the people around you who you love. And that's, I think of it as a big group. I don't just see it as your immediate family. I think about it as all the people in your life who you want to spend time with. And I think about all the people in your life who you might want to spend time with, or people you want to meet. There's no better way to meet new people or to invite people to sit around the table.
Briefly, let's go to a caller. Ingrid is with us now in Eagle River. Hi, Ingrid.
Hi. Yes, I just wanted to relay about an idea about having a potluck that works really well. I have each person bring a particular comfort food from their past, such as meatloaf, macaroni cheese, bread pudding, scalloped potatoes, and that sort of thing, some desserts too. And it just goes over really well.
Ingrid, thank you so much for the call. How about that idea, Leslie?
Oh, I think that is just beautiful. I think comfort food is a great way to bring people together. There's actually Mary White, who lives in Maine, does an annual potluck, but everybody is given the same chicken pot pie recipe, the whole town, and everybody makes the same recipe and brings it, and then they all taste each other's versions. And I love the idea of people making food, bringing it together, and just gathering together around comfort food. I think that's a wonderful way to create community.
Well, Leslie, thank you so much for spending time with us today. It was a real pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciated it.
That was Leslie Jonath, creative director at Connected Dots Media and editor of the cookbook Feed Your People, Big Batch, Big Hearted Cooking and Recipes to Gather Around.
We do have all of those recipes that we talked about today. Those are the root beer barbecue spare ribs, the macaroni au gratin, and the lemon blueberry trifle. Not truffle, it is trifle. That's what threw me earlier. All these recipes are available at WPR.org/Food Friday. And you can continue to share the dishes that you serve for groups. Tweet us at Central Time WPR or put up a post over on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
On this High Note edition, meet the driving force behind opera's renaissance. Luciano Pavarotti even beat out the rockers to top the pop charts. The sport of kings has a new champion. Sly Stallone asks, anyone for polo? Britain's most talked about woman has it all. but behind the fairy tale fantasy.
That was the unmistakable voice of Robin Leach, host of the classic TV series Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous. Robin Leach died this week at the age of 76.
I gotta say, Judith, I was probably a little too young for the show, but I know it. Like, yeah. When I heard this news, I was like, oh, and I heard that voice. And, you know, it was just, Leach was kind of this cultural touchstone almost, where even if you know, didn't really know the show or who was involved, you kind of knew who he was.
Well, and it really was such an 80s ethos, that, you know, glamorizing wealth and these glamorous lifestyles. I remember a lot of kind of like aerial footage of compounds studded with swimming pools and lots of marble.
And dinner tables that had at least like 8 candelabras. Yeah. Like 7 would have been tacky, but 8 was good.
Well, it was quite the show, and Robin Leach was definitely the voice of it. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and WPR, and then Foxconn's plans for its manufacturing plant could be changing. We'll find out more. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Chris Molina. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.